This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 2nd, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 284. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, the MMA panel looks back at the first quarter of 2023 and ahead to the second quarter, with Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or was that an awkward meeting on March 31st of the House of Commons committee that is studying China's interference in federal elections? Former Conservative MP Kenny Chu lost Steveston Richmond East in 2021 after a pro-Chinese communist disinformation campaign. He returned to Ottawa to testify at the committee. He appeared as a witness before this committee that included Parm Baines, the Liberal who, according to a leaked CSIS report, got help from China's Consul General Tang Xiaoling to defeat Chu. Here is a clip of Kenny Chu's statement and questions from a member of the Bloc Québécois.
In 2021, a complete mischaracterization of my proposed establishment of foreign influence registry was circulated in WeChat and WhatsApp groups that it is anti-Chinese or a pretext of a future Chinese internment effort, or that if elected prime minister, the anti-Chinese Aaron O'Toole, then conservative leader, will ban WeChat, jeopardizing the only familial or business link they so rely on. Their goal is twofold: to install a decision makers that they have access to or control of, or to remove those that stand against their efforts, quote unquote, vocal detractors, if you will. To be clear, a beneficiary of these efforts does not necessarily imply collusion. CCP not only honors the age-old philosophy that an enemy's enemy is a friend, they also practice equal paternity among races, corruption and collusion with anybody willing to submit within or outside of the Chinese community.
Donc, vous croyez?
So you believe that your opponent had an advantage?
Yes, that he is the beneficiary of the disinformation.
Okay. Croyez-vous que ce soit...
Do you believe that it's a conflict of interest that your opponent is here today?
That is a question I think it's better answered by my opponent, who is sitting here in the meeting.
D'accord.
Liberal Parm Baines, who has refused to return my phone calls, did not direct any questions to Kenny Chu. But for the first time publicly, Baines addressed his controversial win.
So, as candidates, we're all victims of misinformation and disinformation. When we're in an election and there were a campaign against me that I was going to legalize hard drugs and things of that nature. But I want to go back to maybe Mr. Stanton, because the community I live in has Filipino, Indo-Canadian, Hong Kong, mainland China, strong Muslim Canadian community. We actually have a 5-kilometer corridor in the city. It's called the Highway to Heaven, and it's every religious institution, about 28 of them, all along this corridor. So it's a very, very mixed community that I've lived in my whole life. So it's important to me. I think we had a list of all the nations you were talking about, including USA, India, PRC, Iran, Russia. So, are there more than that we need to be mindful of? And I understand you've said that China is number one. They're the A-team. But are there others that are maybe developing a little bit more? Because it's clear Canada is, as we've said for many years now, you're saying, long-standing target. Everybody wants to trade. Everybody wants to get an advantage. So are there other nations that are emerging?
Well, yeah, I would say in terms of foreign interference, as it's defined in the CSIS Act Section 2, no, there aren't a lot others.
If there is a public inquiry, will Parm Baines volunteer to testify? He was supported by several people involved with the Chinese Communist Party's United Front, and he continues to attend their events. Canadians deserve to know what he knew and when he knew it. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast. And just like that, the first quarter of the 2023 calendar year is over. Onward to the second quarter. But before we go any further, let's pause for the MMA panel. Yes, joining me again is Mario Canseco, president of Research Co., and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program, also known as the Duke of Data, joining me to look at some of the big stories that happened in the first quarter of 2023 and to look ahead with some predictions for the second quarter of 2023. BC Premier David Eby versus Vancouver Mayor Ken Sim. Which politician had the better, more effective first 100 days in office? Mario, go with you.
I think Eby had the best 100 days in office because nothing was broken beyond repair. It was a fairly standard coronation. We're not talking about Anjali Appadurai anymore. I think there's an opportunity to try to work on issues such as housing and ultimately try to figure out what to do about inflation. The budget wasn't particularly crazy as far as the reaction from the opposition. He's got the added benefit of dealing with a seemingly more powerful Conservative Party now that John Rostad has become the leader. And that is going to take votes away from the BC Liberals. I think it's definitely tougher for Ken Sim. Complications with snow removal. We saw some of the tweets. We saw some of the complaints. The situation that has developed over the past couple of weeks, particularly with in regards to the grants that can be given by the city to people who only speak about them in a good way. The controversy over what's going to happen with the bike lanes on Broadway. The comment about whether this isn't really La La Land because you don't have the money. He was talking about bringing swagger back. But when he uses language like that, it more certainly evokes somebody who is drunk with power in a corporate boardroom. And it's probably not the type of language that we want to see happening in a city, which he said he was going to unite.
Where do you see it, Andy?
Well, I mean, I'm always careful with these 100 days because that's taken straight out of the American system. And, you know, if you haven't seen in the last couple of years how the Americans are doing with those ideas, that, I mean, it's a bit problematic that, of course, like, yeah, it's interesting to kind of see a new administration in the short term to kind of come out with, you know, it's a certain levels of change. But then at the same time, it's not going to be the 100 days. It's going to be what happens during the 4 years that you work through. And if you will, the 100 days before you see the next election at each level. So I think to that extent, I think I'm always wary on terms of like grading 100-day performances. If anything, I always have a tendency of saying I grade and incomplete grade. That we'll see what happens as the terms progress for both the provincial and the civic levels. And I think. But however, that all being said, I think I would agree with Mario that I think that Premier Eby has proven a lot less turmoil in terms of what's happening at the provincial office. I think that he's passed through a budget that I think has generally been taken up quite well. I think he has a forthcoming housing strategy that I think it's going to be interesting to kind of see what's going to come out with that housing strategy, having housing at such a high level of concern. But yet, of course, we also have to think about what's going on with healthcare and what we had all earlier talked about is public safety. And so to really kind of see what's going to happen with the next, say, 2 years of Premier Eby's tenure. I think it's going to be interesting. And this, of course, does not preempt the possibility of an election, as a certain person has mentioned here, possibly. But then I think that at the same time, there are still some ongoing challenges with Mayor Sims. I think he's perhaps discovering that running a city is a pretty hard affair in terms of not only what kind of powers you have, but the kind of monies you can ultimately use. I mean, the fact of the matter is he's actually coming in on a 10% property tax increase at a time when he was perhaps promising that there wouldn't be. So I think that it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen, afwards in terms of really what the next 3 years are going to be.
And you alluded to that public safety. I mean, that's one of the big issues facing the province, especially facing urban areas. The downtown east side doesn't look much different than it did last summer. There are still people sleeping out on tents, people with propane heaters. There's fires. There still are some very tragic deaths. The fentanyl overdose crisis still continues. There's the tent cities, such as the one at Crab Park. There has not been as much progress on that file as people had hoped. There also has been the decriminalization of hard drugs that has happened. There is still a lot of human misery down there, the downtown east side, other parts of the province as well. But the downtown east side, of course, is right next door to Chinatown, which is still facing an uphill battle to try to get
loss back of Kent's Kitchen. I mean, for me, that's a civic and a provincial level kind of concern in terms of not only the loss of a long eatery, but actually the erosion of food security for a lot of people in the downtown east side.
Andy, where is the city going to go with public safety, especially when you do have a mayor that came to power promising to do something?
Indeed. And I think what's happening in terms of, that dreadful situation of what happened in front of that Starbucks on a Sunday on broad daylight, Paul Schmidt, a father who was just requesting somebody not vape in front of their child, gets stabbed to death. And I, having been a lifelong Vancouverite, I cannot remember a single time in the history of the city that where you had this type of violence, open violence to people who didn't know each other in broad daylight.
Mario, in your recent polls in recent months from British Columbians, what are they saying and what have they said about this issue, about public safety and where it ranks in their priorities?
Well, it's certainly at a lower level than the big three. We continue to be number one across the country when it comes to housing, homelessness, and poverty, increasing concerns about housing, particularly from the younger generation. Healthcare is climbing the charts, particularly because the over 55s, who are more likely to be the ones who were satisfied with the way the pandemic was managed, are the ones who are saying, thank you for my vaccines. Now I got to get this hip replaced, and it's going to take 3 years, and you guys got to get your act together. And to a lesser extent, economy and jobs, concerns about inflation. Crime and public safety is not yet in double digits. I think there's a possibility that it might grow because of the events of the past couple of weeks. But it's ultimately the kind of thing where you always have this shared responsibility, which is also in a way shared blame. And we don't often see this in the commentary. One of the things that was quite interesting about how this unfolded on social media, aside from people who made the dreadful decision of actually posting the video of what happened, is how nobody complained about the mayor. And we are coming off 3 years of people blaming Kennedy Stewart because the garbage wasn't picked up or there was overflowing garbage in a garbage can at Granville. Somebody got hit, something happened, there was a hate crime, there was an attack. It's all Kennedy Stewart's fault. Nobody's speaking about this as if it is Ken Sims' fault, which just shows us that this isn't something that depends on one person who is in charge of City Hall.
Not yet, but
I think it's something that has to be dealt with on a more sociological level. And part of what I see happening here is, when we get into the type of situation that could have helped something like this not to happen, it's just too complicated to be something that is pinned on one person. And in a way, after 100 days in office, people aren't looking at Ken Sim as somebody who is going to solve this immediately. But if we continue to have something like this, especially with the cozy relationship with the police that we see from the party in power, it could be more complicated. Or we could be in a situation where something happens to somebody under custody. Vancouver has its own George Floyd moment. And then we are into a very different situation when it comes to how we're looking at crime, because right now it's more about how could this happen to us? In a way, I don't think anybody felt this state of shock since the day after the riots, after the Stanley Cup.
Right.
Now, this idea of walking around the city going, am I in danger? Is this okay? Are we all fine? It's part of that collective situation that we're all feeling right now. And it takes a lot of effort from the authorities to try to tell people that they are actually on their side.
Of course, we saw what Prime Minister Justin Trudeau did. Came to the table finally after the premiers were complaining for so many months. He had that healthcare summit, put almost $200 billion of promises for the next decade on the table, including about $46 billion in new funding. The premiers had kind of a mixed response. Some were thumbs down immediately. And then the next week turned around and everyone was singing Kumbaya and the deal was done. There still are hospital waits. There are still people without doctors. There are still hospitals that are not open 24 hours a day in parts of the province. Nothing's really changed except the promise that money is coming along the way. This is going to take a long time to fix. What next for the healthcare situation? Is this just a Band-Aid situation, Mario?
What's funny about the way healthcare is discussed in this country is that if the party in power at the federal level is a party you like, you're going to blame the poor management of the provinces. If the party that you really like is provincial and you're not happy with the feds, you're going to blame it on poor funding. And that's been the case consistently. It was a little bit different when Harper was running the show because you had a lot of provinces where you had the same party running things. Part of what I see here as a challenge is everybody's going to deal with things differently. And BC has a very unique challenge because of how old our population is. It's going to be much more complicated to deal with something like this, even if you don't have as much money as what you asked for, because of the situations that we're facing. Right. Now, this doesn't mean that everybody's enamored with the concept of a healthcare system that can have two tiers. It's not an idea that is popular. There's people who have been fostering that for years, and Canadians just don't think that that's the way it should be. But we're coming back from a lot of empty promises made by both main BC parties. We remember the Liberals said everybody's going to have a family doctor, and that was very quickly abandoned, although it wasn't really deleted from their website, as some certain political party has done in Vancouver. It's more complicated than that, because it's a promise that needs to be met. You know, people are going to be looking at this differently. And I think the main challenge, in a way, is how do you manage the communications around this? When the federal government is telling you billions of dollars are coming in, you need to justify what type of machine you're going to be using, what type of hospital you're going to be building, and what type of situation you need, specifically in the rural areas, which are the ones that are sometimes grossly underserved. So there's really not a significant solution for this. You know, you could ask for more money and they might give it to you, but the implementation of a healthcare system that is going to work, especially with the backlog that we have as far as the waiting lists, is not something that is going to be enjoyed by David Eby by the time the next election rolls around. And I think this is what makes healthcare so complicated. You can plan your campaign around cutting the ribbon at a specific facility for housing or for transportation. With healthcare, you can do something like that.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that really touching upon what Mario just said is that it's a problem that isn't solved by cutting ribbons, but it presents a Gordian knot. And that it's one of those intractable problems and challenges in governance that, you know, it's kind of funny. You haven't necessarily heard what the other alternative ideas might be, what the, you know, what the Conservatives might provide at the provincial level, or the Liberals might provide in something that is such a total sudden change that makes people feel like, oh, whoa, we should really pursue that as an alternative, which I think really shows how intractable the challenges of healthcare is in Canada across any level of government. But then, of course, I guess touching upon an area that I really know quite well of is that it's not only about, say, doctors and healthcare, or much less, say, police and public safety. I mean, these are obviously very important agents in these challenges, but yet there's also these other elements which determine health, the social determinants of health, much less the ideas of public safety that doesn't necessarily just grow in and throwing in money, but then are also, I think, being drastically transformed in terms of problems in labor, problems in demography. Just the simple aging of the population, I think, has kind of put in pressures both in terms of supply and demand, through which, again, I think at all levels of government, we still await, I think, that the killer app, if you will, okay, maybe not talk about killers in healthcare, but then at the same time, the kind of, you know, that the kind of unique kind of approach that I think can actually solve this. And I think, again, we have yet to really hear something that is comprehensively different from what we've done in the past.
With this China crisis for Justin Trudeau, will the foreign interference by China define his time in office? And is the clock ticking on his leadership, Mario?
Well, I think I'll answer the second one first. Chrystia Freeland was making the rounds. She was in Vancouver. The reviews are not particularly impressive from the speech that she gave at the Board of Trade. It's not looking like the type of coronation that we had in the Gretchen and Martin years, which I think is a good analogy and a good thing to point to, because we don't really think of Gretchen and the sponsorship scandal. It's something that ultimately affected Paul Martin more, even though he wasn't responsible for it directly, but he was the one who was in charge when it broke, and all of the situations related to the inquiry happened when Paul Martin was already in office. And that definitely played a role in the length of his stay at 24 Sussex. It might be a situation that is similar to this, you know, essentially preparing to wait at one point and then authorize a full inquiry. And then everything is something that your successor is going to have to deal with. But we know that there's a solution for this. And when we asked about the scandal, if you will, Canadians were highly supportive of a full public inquiry, but the level of support was actually higher for doing what the Australians have done for years, which right. is to ensure that you have a way in which you can deal with this type of situation. Mm-hmm. The law in Australia doesn't establish any difference between somebody who is an elected public official or somebody who is just an Australian citizen, because any person can be turned into a useful idiot by people who know diplomacy. And I think it's a brilliant law. It's something that Canada should try to implement. And it also takes away from the racist aspect of this discussion. You know, is this all about China? Well, no, I think there is a good possibility right. that countries that we have friendly relationships with are actively embroiled in this type of endeavor. You know, funding people to take courses abroad or giving right. money to universities so they can study American exceptionalism. Like, we just came from a President Trump, okay? You don't know what's going to happen with the United States and how that type of influence is going to come back and bite you. So I think that would be the solution for me. Have an Australia-style law that limits the influence of foreign governments. Have a registry of people who are talking to each other. And this way, we're not going to be able to deal with something and say, well, it's okay to be in bed with these people because these are our friends. It's our enemies who we shouldn't be in bed with.
Well, I think a lot of this is, I mean, upon the kind of cries of anti-Chinese racism over this, that I think it's a distraction because it doesn't acknowledge what the Canada we are, much less what the future of the world will be. And I think that it's very clear that it's transnational, that it's a back and forth of people and ideas that is going to move back and forth. But then unlike what used to be, say, you know, and I always talk about, well, the first kind of example of foreign influence was, you know, the assassination of Darcy McGee and the kind of issues around Ireland. And, you know, but then, you know, back then it took, what, 2 weeks for a long-held letter, a long-form letter to kind of pass through from these two places, as opposed to the milliseconds in terms of social media. that we just have right now. And that I think this really comes down to really modernizing our system, really to recognize the kind of Canada that we've become in terms of our the strengths, but yet the challenges of a transnational world. And I think this is learning from the Australians. And then I think also a bit off the Americans, and to understand that between those, we can learn from around the world of how to really ensure that our democracy is transparent and accountable and safe. And that it isn't just about the Chinese in this situation. It's really connected up to China. It's connected up to Iran. It's connected up to India. It's connected up to many of the diasporic communities that make up our country, that contribute a level of richness to our life in Canada, that we as a multicultural democracy is willing to defend and protect. That I think that this is where a foreign registry sits, is that it's to defend and to protect the democratic institutions, rights, and freedoms that we enjoy in this country.
Yeah, you mentioned the Irish there, of course, the Fenian raids of the 1860s and 1870s. That was one of the earliest examples of foreign interference in Canada. And I wonder if we'll see any interesting plot twists. Of course, in the first quarter, the first anniversary of Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. We also saw the Xi and Putin summit in Moscow. The Xi and Putin bromance continues. And meanwhile, on this side of the water in North America, stormy days ahead for dumped Trump. Donald Trump indicted, first president in history indicted. Andy, what do you think on that? Do you think the Ukraine war will get worse or get better? And where do you think Donald Trump will be after the second quarter?
I think the Ukraine war is going to be highly dependent upon the ongoing support of the West, of NATO, onto the Ukrainians. And should that ever waver, that would, I mean, that's basically the end. And I think that that really is going to be one of the kind of ongoing challenges in terms of, say, what's, and deeply connected towards all the previous other issues, particularly in American politics, that you will have, I think, that kind of question is that will the Ukraine war in one way will depend on what happens to American domestic politics and how that support will be ongoing or will change or waver, I think is the key question. I think for all our sakes, that it is something that I think needs to be resolved. And yet at the same time, there still seems to be no real end in sight. And I think that this is going to be, I think, one of the kind of ongoing issues that we may be very well even talking about at the end of the year.
I do agree with Andy. I think both are connected. There's a chance that the Russians expect Trump to be reelected, to come back in 2024, and then everything is back to normal and we can do whatever we want. This might seem like it's a long time away, but it's less than 2 years away. So we'll have to figure out what is going to come out of that. And ultimately, I think this is really depending on Vladimir Putin's own health. If the situation with him deteriorates and they have to make decisions about who's going to be calling the shots, it'll be easier for the Russian government to say the new person is going to say that we declare victory. They do their mission accomplished thing the way Bush did it in Iraq. And that'll be that, even if nothing comes out of it. The Trump situation is very complicated. I think he's stubborn enough to try to continue to be a presidential candidate, even if he's indicted. The Republicans are going to have to make a decision on whether they want to pursue something like this, knowing that this is going to throw off their base and knowing that they can't solely depend on the hardcore MAGA vote in order to win the states that they need to win. You know, if we were coming off the election of 2016, it would be a lot easier, but 2020 saw a significant drop in support in states that he won in 2016. And there's nothing to suggest that somebody who has been indicted and who could quite possibly be sent to jail is going to be able to rekindle with that particular group. That being said, I don't think he'll spend time behind bars. I think they'll figure out a way to make a plea bargain. He's always said and tweeted repeatedly that only guilty people plea bargain. I think this is going to be his chance to taste a little bit of that medicine. And he'll be able to say, but I didn't go to jail, even though I did a plea bargain, but I had to do a plea bargain because everything was rigged.
So could we see an election before we get into summer? What do you think, Mario?
I don't think it'll happen now. My estimation is they'll try to do it early, but it'll still be 2024. Not call it in October 2024, but probably do it in May. You do the justification and saying campaigning in October was easy because of COVID in 2020 and we had to do it, but you know, we always vote in the spring. We're used to voting in May. We're essentially doing the election at the same time that we should, which is May, and it's the earliest possible moment we can call it and still do it in May without breaking the rules and doing it in May 2025. So my estimation is it'll be in 2024, but it'll be not in October as it is supposed to be, but in May, which is the way it's supposed to be if they hadn't called it early in 2020.
Andy, what do you think? Election in the second quarter? I mean, the MLAs were elected back in 2017, will reach their maturity and be eligible for their pensions. But do you think David Eby will wait until that moment and then call an election, or do, as Mario said, wait until 2024, not in the fall, but do it in the spring?
I think it will depend upon really, I think, how people are feeling about the economy, how they're looking at housing, how they're feeling about public safety and healthcare. But I think I do agree with Mario on this. I don't see a new election coming up anytime soon. I think that there's, I think, a way of kind of, I think, bubbling through, especially when there isn't necessarily a real, I mean, it's interesting. Do you spring an election now and have what is, you know, an opposition that is still, you know, coalescing, or do you actually have a election later on to have a track record? And I think that this is really an interesting kind of question. I don't see a sudden election coming up. I see one that is going to be one of kind of coalescing the team to kind of ensure that there's a level of delivery. And then I think that that's going to be when the election is. But I think Mario's right. They won't play it out to October. They may kind of pull it out closer to a spring election.
What do you think will happen in the second quarter? Will Mike Farnworth greenlight the Surrey Police Service to continue and to take over from the RCMP, or will he say sayonara to Norm Lipinski and keep the RCMP in Surrey? Which way do you think he'll go?
That's really, I think, a important question here. I think that, of course, mixed into all this is the direct attribution towards a 9.5% property tax increase due to the pursuit of a Surrey police force. And one wonders if it's going to be a rather amicable negotiation with the province through which all parties will step down in terms of avoiding the affiliation to a 9.5% property tax increase. And we may actually see the reemergence of the RCMP for the practicality that nobody wants to be associated to a 9.5% property tax increase.
Mario, which way do you think it'll go?
Yeah, I think it's going to be very complicated to go against the wishes of the mayor on this one. That being said, I do blame the BC government for even allowing Doug McCallum to do something like this. To borrow the term from Nelson Muntz in The Simpsons, both the mandate from Doug McCallum in 2018 and the current mayor in 2022 are powerfully weak. There's very few votes in your favor in low turnout elections to say, I have a mandate to do this. And I think we would not be in this type of situation if the BC government at the time had said to Doug McCallum, you just don't have the gravitas to try to do something like this, even if you promised it, because the level of support that you have for this is negligible at best. And it's only going to be a nightmare that somebody else is going to have to deal with. We are now at the stage where we are the ones who have to deal with it. So this never should have been attempted. But now that it has, it's going to be very complicated for the government to go against the mayor of Surrey and say, we're just going to stick to whatever we think is best because we've spent a lot of money already. But again, this could have been stopped. You know, we're always having conversations about jurisdiction and why is the mayor of this city talking about climate change? Why is the BC government talking about drugs? This is your perfect example. It never should have been allowed to see the light of day, particularly with the low level of support that McCallum had, which suddenly he interpreted as you know, a magnificent, perfect victory when it clearly wasn't.
Well, that's it again for the MMA panel on the Breaker.News podcast, looking back at the first quarter of 2023. and having some fearless predictions for the second quarter of 2023. Mario Canseco, a research co, and Andy Yan of the City Program at Simon Fraser University.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, CCP paid Chinese gangsters $200 each to crash Taiwan president's New York arrival. Legislator Wang Tingyu says gangsters paid by China to harass the elected head of state. On the first leg of her Democratic Partnership for Common Prosperity journey, President Tsai Ing-wen landed in New York on March 29th. Hundreds of Chinese protesters tried to spoil her arrival, but were forced by security personnel to stand behind barricades on the other side of the street from Taiwanese supporters. On March 30th, Tsai Ming-yen, the new Director General of the National Security Bureau, said that he is fully aware that China directed the consulates in Los Angeles and New York to mobilize pro-Chinese associations to protest against the president. In Kyoto news, man indicted in wake of viral video of him licking soy sauce bottle. The case of Ryoga Yoshino, 21, is believed to have been the first sentence of a customer being arrested for such behavior following revelations of similar acts at eateries in Japan earlier this year. The young man recognized the error of his ways during the detention and, if afforded the chance, hopes to apologize to the sushi restaurant chain operator, the lawyer said. The Kura Sushi restaurant chain operator installed camera systems equipped with artificial intelligence on the conveyor belts at its restaurants after the incident. In the Hong Kong Free Press, winners of Hong Kong's free flights say additional charges more than expected. Some winners also said they had never heard of the government's Hello Hong Kong campaign, under which 500,000 air tickets are being distributed to lure visitors back to the tourism-starved city. Two winners, both from Singapore, told Hong Kong Free Press that when they attempted to book their flights on the Cathay Pacific website using their redemption codes, they were prompted to pay around 1,150 Hong Kong dollars in carrier surcharges and taxes. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Spencer Webb's girlfriend announces birth of son, Spider Webb. Kelly Green, the model girlfriend of the late Oregon Ducks tight end Spencer Webb, announced she gave birth to their son on Thursday, Spider Webb. Spencer Webb's nickname was Spider. Green was visiting Webb, 22, at the time of his fatal fall while climbing a cliff near Triangle Lake last July 13th. In the Seattle Times, Seattle set aside $100,000 for street sinks. 2 years later, where are they? The street sink concept was simple in theory. Add water sources around Seattle for the more than 3,700 people surviving outside who need a place to wash their hands or take a drink of water. Nearly 2.5 years after Seattle City Council set aside $100,000 to pay for an estimated 40 sinks, five have been installed. The people pay to install the sinks point to bureaucratic red tape and heavy regulations slowing the process. In the Times Colonist, Aquarium agrees to return Lolita the orca to Pacific 50 years after capture. Lolita was part of a pod of the endangered southern resident killer whales that roam waters off British Columbia and the U.S. Northwest. The Dolphin Company, owner of the Miami Seaquarium, where the whale lives, the nonprofit Friends of Lolita, and businessman Jim Irsay, owner of the NFL's Indianapolis Colts, developed the plan. Lolita will likely be moved in 18 to 24 months, but it could happen earlier. The Lummi Nation, along with organizations such as People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, have been fighting for years for Lolita's release. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to nurses around BC who care for cancer patients and who help prevent cancer. April 4th is Oncology Nursing Day in BC. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 2nd, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 2nd of April in 1991, Rita Johnston became the first female Premier of Canada after BC Premier Bill Van Der Zandt resigned in the Fantasy Gardens conflict of interest scandal? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.